I'd like to read a verse with you in Ecclesiastes chapter 11. Ecclesiastes chapter 11. For sake of time, we'll read only one verse, verse number 6. In the morning, sow thy seed, and in the evening, withhold not thine hand. For thou knowest not whether shall prosper, either this or that, or whether they both shall be alike good. In the morning sow thy seed, and in the evening withhold not thy hand. Now God will bless us this very brief reading of his precious word. The figure of a sower brought before us in this verse is a very common figure in the scriptures. You'll find it used in the Old Testament, you'll find it used in the New Testament, and you'll find, if you look at the portions of scripture where we get that figure, that it's used in a wide variety of contexts. Now, we're not going to take time to go into all that this evening, but if you would think of some of the best-known occurrences of it, you would see just how wide a scope it really embraces. You remember Psalm number 126, where we read of that one going forth with tears and reaping with joy, going forth and weeping, returning again, bringing the sheaves with him. Or when you come over into the New Testament, and think of such passages as 2 Corinthians chapter 9, or Galatians chapter 6, or even the parable of the sower in Matthew 13, you'll see that the picture of a sower is really common to the scriptures and embraces a very wide scope. But for our purpose this evening, I want to look at this verse and to think of sowing simply as sowing the good seed of the gospel. And in the verse we have read together, we're encouraged to sow the seed. In the morning sow thy seed, and in the evening withhold not thy hand. We're encouraged to sow the seed, and we're encouraged to sow it continually, constantly. To take every opportunity, and when no opportunity arises, to make opportunity. In the morning sow thy seed, and in the evening withhold not thy hand. The reason why we're to be so constant in the sowing of the seed is because we don't really know which will prosper, either this or that. It is profitable to notice in this 11th chapter just how many things we really don't know. If you read down the opening verses of the chapter, you'll find that expression time and time again. Ye know not. And this is one of the things we don't know. We don't really know the results of our sowing. We must sow at every opportunity because we don't know what will be the outcome. That's not given us to see. Our privilege, not to say responsibility, is to sow the seed. The producing of results is in God's hand. Therefore, in the morning sow thy seed, and in the evening withhold not thy hand. Perhaps we could look at it in another way. In the morning of your life, while you still have the strength and vitality of youth, with that boundless energy and enthusiasm that's characteristic of youth, in the morning of your days, sow the seed. Even when old age is upon you, in the eventide of your days, when energy and strength are a thing of the past, withhold not thy hand. In the morning sow thy seed, and in the evening withhold not thy hand. When we think of the morning time of our life, youth, with all its boundless energy, with its vision and ambition and enthusiasm, what a wonderful opportunity is ours to use that youth for God. Could I say to the younger in our meeting this evening that you'll only be young once? It's a fact we all know. But sometimes we forget just how important that really is. Only once will you be young. You'll find that that youth of yours will pass all too quickly. Before you realize it, the strength will begin to wane. Old age will come on. And I feel it's a real pity. If we were to use the prime of our life, the best years, the strongest years of our life, for things which in 100 years from now will have no further value. Use our strength, our energy, our intelligence, our drive for things of earth. To make a position for ourselves here. To provide something that we've got to leave behind. And to miss the golden opportunity of using those early years for God. It's vitally important that we should start young, using our youth for God. But there's more to it than that, because many a one has made a good start that hasn't continued. And I would say to all this evening, in the morning of your life, sow the seed, and in the evening, withhold not thy hand. In the sowing of the good seed of the Word of God, we never come to the age of retirement. It's a lifetime job. Better still, it's a lifetime's privilege to sow the seed and to watch as God gives ample return for everything that has been done. There's much more I would love to say about that, but we must leave it and turn our thoughts to Brazil. And as we think of the land of Brazil, I would like very briefly this evening, as God would help, to let you see something of what God is doing in that land. I always find it a very difficult task. You may think that surprising, but if you think for a moment or two, you'll see what I mean. I could occupy all the time here this evening telling you of people that have got saved, of assemblies that have been formed, of the triumphs of the gospel. And everything that I would say about that could be absolutely true and yet gives you an entirely wrong impression. If you were to hear only of progress and success, you might go home thinking that everything was wonderful in Brazil. On the other hand, I could take up all the time telling you true stories of disappointments, of discouragements, of dark days of defeat. It would all be true, but again it would leave a very wrong impression. And just to give a balanced picture, to present the picture as it really is, it's not easy. I personally would like to dwell more on the encouraging side and tell you more about people getting saved than to occupy your minds with discouragement. Yet, as God would enable, we'll do our best to give you a true and a balanced picture of the Lord's work as we see it. And there again, we must add something else. We can only tell you about the Lord's work in Brazil as we see it today. I'm aware of the fact that there is a day coming when we'll see the work as God sees it, as it really is. What a day of revelation that will be, when each one of us stands before the judgment seat of Christ. And there we'll see things as God sees. I feel it's good for us if we can keep that always in mind. You know, it steadies us in our service for God. It enables us to avoid many a pitfall and many a snare. But coming back again to Brazil, I think we should, first of all, make one or two general comments about it to let you see the type of a country we're talking about. Perhaps everyone knows that it's a really large country. Like Canada, it's a very, very large country. In that vast land today, we have at least 130 million people. It's a rapidly increasing population, growing rapidly because of immigration. And at the moment, that population would be estimated at around about 130 million or more. It's a Roman Catholic country. Although it is a Roman Catholic country, we have freedom to preach the gospel. The government has guaranteed absolute freedom for everyone. No restrictions whatever are placed upon our movements. We can travel freely in that country wherever we think we should go. We can preach the gospel in the open air, indoors. We can give out gospel tracts. No restrictions whatever are placed upon us. That has been a blessing, and at the same time it has opened the door for many, many problems. Almost every religious organization that you have ever heard of has taken full advantage of that open door in Brazil. The result is that today in Brazil we have a tremendous confusion of religion. All the Protestant denominations are there. And could I say in passing, just about as dead as it's possible to be. As well as that, we have all the more modern groups. These modern cults are all very active there as well. No matter where you'll go, you'll find Mormons and so-called Jehovah's Witnesses and all the lot. As well as that, of course, we have a tremendous influx of Oriental religions, African religions. And to crown it all, everywhere you go in Brazil, you see the very evident influence of Spiritism. Well, in such a confusing situation, it's not easy to preach the gospel. But we're thankful to say that over the years that the gospel has been preached in Brazil, God has blessed us in a wonderful way. For quite a number of years now, the gospel has been preached. And quite a number of brethren and sisters have gone from other lands to Brazil to preach the gospel. We're thankful for everyone that God has sent to preach the gospel there. I first went to Brazil in 1960, 23 years ago. I'll never forget that first day I arrived in the town of Porto Alegre, way down in the south of Brazil, almost on the Uruguayan border. I spent the first 5 years in that southern corner of Brazil. The first few months, of course, were occupied in learning the language. Then, as God enabled, we began to preach the gospel. There are quite a number of missionary brethren in that southern corner of Brazil. Those were five happy, prosperous years. After about 5 years there, we felt that we should leave that part of Brazil because many large areas of that vast country are still untouched. There are those assemblies that we have mentioned right down in the extreme south where we spent the first 5 years, and then in other parts of the country, right away up to the Amazon jungle in the north of Brazil, you will find here and there groups of assembly. But in vast areas of that country, there are no assemblies whatever. That was a real burden to me in those early days and still is today. So in 1965, we left the southern corner of Brazil and moved about 1,000 miles north until we came to the large state of São Paulo, which is the most populous state in Brazil. We moved into the interior of that state, into a place called Descalvado. There was no assembly there. Never had been any assembly work in that town or district. We were moving into new ground and starting off from scratch. We have been around that area ever since. Not exactly in that one town, but living in that town and working out around the whole region. And I'm very thankful to say that God has blessed the preaching of the gospel there. And I trust that what we have to say about it this evening will be an encouragement to you. I'll take a few minutes to tell you about the early days in Descalvado to let you see how everything started. And then we'll come to more recent times to have some more up-to-date information. When we started in Descalvado, it was very slow, discouraging work. There was no gospel hall. There were no believers. We had no friends. We started going around from door to door, knocking on the doors, giving out gospel tracts, talking to the people. After a short time, we managed to rent a little room for meetings. Not a very big room. Made a few seats, got everything ready to start meeting. When the hall was ready, we went around the doors again, inviting everyone to come. At that time, there must have been about 16,000 people living in that town. We went around from street to street, from door to door, inviting all those people to come. One night, we had 9 people present. That was the biggest meeting. Many times, we were quite happy to preach to 2 or 3. And on many occasions, we went along after a day spent on the doorsteps and opened that little hall and dusted the seats and waited in vain for anyone to come. Just couldn't have a meeting because no one turned up. Those were discouraging days. They were days of sowing. But we must sow the seed if ever we hope to reap. And so by the grace of God, we continued sowing. But results were quite some time in appearing. They didn't come immediately. And when they did come, they came slowly. One now and another again. If you go to Descalvado today, you'll find a very different situation. In Descalvado today, there is a nice gospel hall. In that gospel hall, you would notice a company of believers gathering regularly. They're there every Lord's Day to remember the Lord. They gather there for gospel preaching. They go there for Bible readings, for prayer meetings. It's not a big assembly, about 25 in fellowship. But when I think back to those early days, when no one would come to the gospel meeting, and think of that little assembly today, it causes me to thank God for what He has done. It's abundant recompense for everything that has been put into it. But there's more to it than that. Not only is there an assembly in Descalvado today, but from that assembly, the gospel has been sounding out in neighboring towns. Some of those brethren have spent a lot of time preaching the gospel and taking the gospel to their fellow countrymen. The result is that today, round about that district, you would find a number of assemblies, 5 in all. As well as that assembly in Descalvado, there's one in a large town called São Carlos. The town of São Carlos has well over 100,000 of a population. The little assembly would have about 30 in fellowship. There's another assembly in a little town called Ibaté. Some 4 or 5 years ago, a little assembly was planted in a town called Pirasununga. And then just last year, we had the joy of seeing yet another assembly planted in a town called Porto Ferreira. Now, perhaps it would be interesting to tell you about one or two of the brethren in those assemblies, and that might be the best way of letting you see just what's going on around that district today. We'll take Porto Ferreira as an example. It's the most recently formed of those assemblies. The first time that the saints met to break bread in that town was in November last year. The first time we went to that town to try to spread the gospel was as far back as 1968, perhaps. For 2 or 3 years, we tried to get an opening in that town and spent quite a lot of time on the doorsteps. But the first meetings were held in 1970. Very little was seen for it at that time, but the work continued. A little series of meetings in a portable hall that had been erected there, and then when that series of meetings was over, a weekly meeting was carried on every Tuesday night. At that Tuesday night meeting, sometimes half a dozen people would come. Sometimes no one would come, but we would carry on. And from time to time, try another series of meetings, and constantly trying to get into the homes of the people. But right through the 1970s, there seemed to be very little response. We did see an elderly man and his wife saved, but very soon after that, they were both taken home to the glory. That left us back at square one again where we had started. Then one or two more got saved, and by the time we came into 1980, there were 3 women and 1 man in that town, saved, baptized, and in fellowship in the assembly over in Descalvado, which is about 10 miles away. In 1980, the tide began to turn. We began to reap a little of the seed that had been sown over the past years. We did have the joy of seeing a number saved. Numbers began to increase at the meeting. And we're thankful that the day did dawn when we were able to sit down around a table in November and remember the Lord in that time. There's one young man in that assembly that I would like to mention that you might pray for him and pray for his family. He was brought up in a fairly well-to-do family, Roman Catholics. But at a fairly early age, he got away from parental restraint. Didn't like to be hemmed in by his parents. Began to go from bad to worse. Drink, drugs, and all the rest. Soon got involved in one of the youth gangs that roam those towns in Brazil. I suppose you have them here as well. Young men that seem to have nothing else to do but roam the streets at night, looking for fights or trying to cause trouble. He was a violent young man, but I'm not going to take time mentioning his black past. Suffice it to say, it was just as black and sinful as drugs and drink can make anyone. One night he almost lost his life in a fight. And after a very close escape, managed to get home again in the small hours of the morning, but he couldn't sleep. He was really troubled that night. He could see that if he would go on as he was going, life was at an end. He would soon be killed, or kill someone and spend the rest of his days in jail. So he decided it was time to become religious. Well, there are many, many religions in that town. He didn't want to go back to the Roman Catholic Church, so he tried everything else that he could think of. He went round the lot. He didn't stay very long at any of them. He was shrewd enough to see that there was nothing for him in religion. He even tried the Mormons, and they were very keen to get him to some sort of a school to make him into a missionary. He was a very intelligent, bright fellow, but he was having nothing of that. Eventually, he came to the conclusion that there was nothing for him in religion. He didn't know where to go. He didn't know what to do. One day he spoke to his neighbor about it, and told this neighbor of the despair that filled his heart. He said, "You know, there's nothing left for me in life. I think it's all over. I've tried religion and there's nothing in it." It so happened that that neighbor man had been along to the gospel hall. Perhaps 3 or 4 times he came to our gospel meeting and then stopped coming. I went along to see him to ask why he had stopped coming to the meetings to see if he would come back again, and he told me straight that he wouldn't be back. I asked him why. He said, "Well, if you really want to know why I won't go back, I hope you won't be offended, but I'll tell you straight. Every time I went there, it was just the same message. As you've heard it once, you've heard it always. Every time I went, it was just sin and death and judgment and hell and Christ and salvation and nothing else. And when I got home, I couldn't sleep. But every time I went to that meeting, I spent a sleepless night, and I'm not going back." Well, we tried to persuade him to come back, but he wouldn't come. Anyhow, the young lad I was telling you about spoke to this man, told him of his despair. That man asked him if he had been to the gospel hall. He said, "No, I've seen that wee hall down the road, but I never thought of going there. Sure, nobody goes to that place." Well, the man said, "I think you should go." He said, "I've been there. I didn't like it, but I think it's the only thing that would suit you." The young man did come, and I'm very thankful to be able to tell you tonight that he got saved. After he did get saved, he began to tell us some of the details of how it happened. I'll maybe pick out 1 or 2 points that might be of interest. First of all, he said that when he went to the gospel hall that evening, the very first meeting, he said he was absolutely convinced that this was what he was looking for. He told us, "You see, every other place I went to, I could see the emptiness of the whole thing. They were all out to attract and to please the people. There was so much entertainment, so much to make the people feel at home, and then they would slip in a wee word or two of the scriptures at the end and try to win people that way." He said, "I saw the emptiness of the whole thing. But when I walked into that gospel hall and saw absolutely nothing geared to attract the people nor to please the people, nothing but the scriptures, nothing but a plain, simple preaching of the gospel," said, "that impressed me. And I felt if there is sincerity at all, it's got to be here." So he said, "I decided to keep coming." He kept on coming and soon became really concerned about his soul. I remember well one Friday evening. By this time he'd been coming for maybe a couple of months to the meetings. I was going to a meeting in another town, maybe some 25 or 30 miles away, that arranged to take him with me. On that Friday evening, I called round at his home, and as the young man left his home and got into the car, I could see immediately that things were different. You see, he was always a very bright fellow, an extrovert, always talking and happy, and he was always the center of every conversation and everything that was going on. But that night was different. He got into the car and not a word. He would speak to nobody. Others would speak to him and he wouldn't even answer. We went to the meeting and came home the same way. He got out of the car and went into his home and didn't even say good night. I didn't see him again until the Lord's Day. And when I met him on the Lord's Day, he came to me and said, "I suppose you thought there was something wrong on Friday night." I said, "I did. What was it?" He said, "Well, I very nearly didn't go to the meeting on Friday night. In fact, I had decided not to go." He said, "I don't know why I did go, When you stopped at the door, well, I felt I just had to go, but I had really decided not to go. He said, when I was at work on Friday, I came to the conclusion that there was no salvation for me. You see, for weeks, I had been trying to get saved. I'd been trying to overcome sin. I felt that if only I could overcome sin and stop sinning, then God would save me. But every time I tried, I failed. Every time I made up my mind not to do a certain thing again, I would be doing it before I would know what I was doing. But that Friday I was really in despair. But every time I tried, I failed. Every time I made up my mind not to do a certain thing again, I would be doing it before I would know what I was doing. But that Friday I was really in despair. I made up my mind to make one final, last, desperate effort. When I left work on Friday, he said, I tried to walk home with my eyes closed. He said, I'm sure you'll laugh at that. But there are so many things that you see, even walking down the street, that would even suggest a sinful thought. And I was determined to overcome my sin in the hope that God would save me. He said, I couldn't do it. By the time I got home, I knew I was beaten. But I wasn't angry with God. I knew he was perfectly just in sending me to hell. Others had got saved, but they hadn't been so sinful as I had been. I felt I was lost, I was beyond mercy. I said, I'm glad I went to the meeting on Friday night. But when I got to that meeting, the scriptures were opened, and the speaker read one verse only. Behold the Lamb of God, beareth away the sin of the world, said in a moment I saw. I had been striving and struggling to overcome something that another had taken away 2,000 years ago. That the burden rolled away. Thank God that young man was saved. That was only the beginning of his troubles, not the end of them. See, his mother, although she was a Roman Catholic, she was a spiritist medium. She began to work to try to get this idea, as she thought it was, out of her son's head. Quite a number of members of that family were spiritist mediums. They put on the pressure as only they can do. But it wouldn't work for them. You know, it's a remarkable thing. We have seen the power of demons and evil spirits in Brazil. And it is a fact they do have power. Tremendous power. But it's also a fact that they're powerless to touch one in whom dwells the Spirit of God. And all their efforts fail. That dear woman was alarmed at what had happened to her son. She couldn't understand it, and she did everything she could to get him away from the meetings. It failed. Then her husband began to do what he could do. He couldn't get him away either. And after perhaps 2 or 3 months of real persecution, one Sunday evening, we were surprised to see that man and his wife walk into the gospel hall. After the meeting that evening, I was talking to them. They asked me if I would go to their home for a gospel meeting. That man said he wanted to speak to me. He said, you know, since our boy started coming to this hall, there has been such a change in his life. His mother used all the means at her disposal in spiritism to try to keep him away from this place. She couldn't do it. I tried to use the means at my disposal, he said, to get this Christianity out of his mind, and I couldn't do it. That before he started coming here, my boy was a real terror in the house. That I wouldn't have dared speak to him. He might have lifted a bread knife and stuck it into me. But when I saw him coming here, I was determined to stop him. I tried to provoke him, tried to get him to fight, tried to make him lose his temper. I tried every way to see if I could ruin his Christianity. But I can't get a cross word out of him. The more I mock him, the more I provoke him, he just leaves me and goes into the kitchen and helps his mother with some housework. He never did that before. But I can't understand what it's all about. But he would like to have a meeting in the house. Well, just before coming home in November, I had the privilege of having two gospel meetings in that home. Since then, we've had letters from that town. That man and his wife are still not saved, but they're going along to the gospel meeting. Some other members of the family have been along to the gospel meeting as well. And I would commend that family to you for your prayers, that God might further work in that family. They might yet see them all gathered in and saved. Now it has been an encouragement to see God working, not only in that town, but in other towns all around. Rather than take up more time telling you about more individuals in that area, I would like to tell you about another place, quite a long distance from that. Going on towards the center, the interior of Brazil, some 350 miles beyond Descalvado, there is a little town called Tupi Paulista. I first went there in 1967. It was a long, long journey. We went because one of the brethren from San Carlos, which is quite near Descalvado, told us of his brother-in-law who lived in Tupi Paulista. He said, my brother-in-law is nominally a Roman Catholic, but in actual fact, he's a spiritist. But he needs to hear the gospel, and I would like to go and take the gospel to him and to his family. And I would like you to come with me. Well, we went. It was a long, long journey. We got there and spent a night in that dear man's home. We sat up that night until the small hours of the morning, putting the gospel before that family, but they didn't seem to have much interest. We went back a number of times. Any time we had an opportunity, we would take that long journey, spend a few hours with them and put the gospel before them. But as far as we could see, there was no interest. We were mistaken. The man was really interested, and we didn't know it. For some months, we weren't able to get back. Doors were opening in other places. We were occupied with meetings in places near Descalvado. And for perhaps 5 or 6 months, maybe more, we didn't get back to Tupi Paulista. That dear man was really concerned about what he had heard. And so he began to look around to see if there was anywhere that he could hear the gospel. Fortunately, in the town where he was living, he did find one place where he heard something about the gospel. And he got saved. His wife got saved. His daughter got saved, and her husband also got saved. All four of them. They continued going to that place, and then they decided that they should get baptized. It was a denominational place, we'll not mention its name, but the man in charge there decided that he would have one or two studies to prepare these people for baptism. That's the way they were working. Well, during this time when he was getting all things ready to baptize the four converts, these four, in their own private study of the scriptures, had come across something that they'd never known before. The young man had been reading in 1 Corinthians. And when he got to chapter 11, he was really impressed. So when the man responsible for that place they were going to came round to see him, he asked him about it. He said, I've been reading in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. As far as I can see, it seems to teach that in the meetings, the sisters should have their heads covered. why is it that in your place they don't use any head covering? Well, the dear man began to explain. He said, well, actually the covering that is required is a covering that God has given to them, their hair. As long as they have long hair, they don't need anything else. That young man, without a smile on his face, he said, well, I'm very sorry. I'm not able to go back to your place anymore. That surprised him. He said, why can't you come back? He said, well, I'm sorry, I can't go back because of the interpretation you have given me of 1 Corinthians chapter 11. You see, if hair is the covering, well, the sisters are covered. But the brethren must be uncovered and this won't come off, so I can't go back. Well, we didn't know anything about this. But the following Lord's Day, we were just finishing our midday meal and I was getting ready to go out when a knock came to the door. I went to the door and there were those four people from Turkey Paulista. They had driven almost 400 miles that morning to come to Discount Valley. They said they wanted to talk to me and ask a few questions. They told me first of all how they got saved and all about it. And then they said, now we want to get straight to the point, but we haven't very much time. We must get back to the Tupi Paulista tonight, but we have to work tomorrow morning early. The first question I want to ask, said the young man, is how you understand 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Well, we explained it to him as we believe it, and he was delighted. That was just exactly what he had thought. Then had one or two other questions about baptism, about other things related to an assembly. And when he had finished asking his questions, he told me what had happened in the interview a few days earlier. He said, well, after the talk today, that's it, finally decided. We're not going back to that place again. We must be guided by the Scriptures. We have come here today to ask you to come to the Tupi Paulista and have meetings in our home. Well, that was the beginning of days of blessing in that town. We did have meetings there. We didn't see any great results immediately. But through the testimony of those people, they were able to get neighbors and friends in to listen to the gospel. And little by little, fruit was gathered. Then a little assembly was established there. It still goes on today, not very big. There might be about 16 or 17 in fellowship there today. They're about 300 miles or more from the nearest assembly. They're all out on their own. But although they're small and isolated, not getting much help, they have been reaching out with the gospel into a neighboring town. Just beyond them is a town called Monte Castello. Over a year ago, they were able to rent a nice little hall in that town. In fact, it was a hall that had been built for, I was going to say gospel preaching, but I don't suppose you could call it gospel preaching. It was built for a so-called evangelical denomination. They tried it for a while and it all fell through. And it was up for sale. The person who owned that hall was trying to sell it, couldn't get it sold. It no longer was property of that denomination, it was now owned by a private owner, but he couldn't get it sold, it was of no use to anyone. So the brethren from Tupi Paulista went through to see him, and they managed to rent it off him for quite a reasonable rent. They began to have meetings there. And I've had the joy of going there and preaching the gospel. Last time I was there, in November, that little hall was full. Not a big hall, there must have been about 35 or 40 people there, and that was the hall full. Since the brethren took over that little hall, they have had the joy of seeing one or two profess to be saved. One woman who lives in that town is not in fellowship in the assembly of the people. We're thankful to see how from that little company, the gospel is reaching into other places. Now I could go on telling you about still other companies of that same type, but we refrain, for our time is almost gone. And I would like to draw to a conclusion by coming back again to Descalvado and the region round about. As you think of those little assemblies there today, I would ask you to pray for them. They're small. They have many difficulties to face. And very seldom do they get a visitor from outside. Can you imagine what it would be like with a small assembly of a couple of dozen, with very, very few visitors from outside to bring a word of encouragement? And as well as that, to face difficulties in gospel work, the same difficulties that I faced in Descalvado in 1967, they face today. The people are just as indifferent as they were then. They won't come to meeting. But yet, those dear brethren are constantly striving to spread the gospel. Sometimes they'll plod on for months and months with no apparent return. But they're still plodding on. And slowly the work is growing. All of those assemblies are growing slowly, but steadily. But you know what human nature is. It's so easy to become discouraged. It's so easy just to settle down. They could say, well, we have five assemblies here, we can have fellowship one with another, and we'll just be content with that and settle down. When you look at the New Testament, you see a very solemn warning. You take the epistles that were written by Paul and go through them one by one. There's one lesson that stands out very clearly before my mind. If you think of Corinth, for example, how Paul took the gospel to Corinth, Paul must have labored faithfully, put the very best of teaching and example into the planting of that assembly. 5 years after he left it, an epistle was written that reveals terrible conditions, how that assembly was turned aside. If you leave Corinthians and go into the epistle to the Galatians, you think of the faithful labors put into the formation of those assemblies, and in a short time the very doctrine of the gospel was corrupted. Leave that and go into Ephesus, then into Philippi, then right through your New Testament. What a list of failures of departure. You see, the devil is a tireless foe. Wherever he sees a company of God's people honestly seeking to serve God and to go according to his word, there's a target for his attack. And I would ask very especially for your prayers for the preservation of those little companies. You know, we need to constantly pray one for another, that we might be preserved in ways that are pleasing to God. I feel that's of vital importance. It's not really of importance to have numbers or to have activity if it's not based entirely upon the Scripture. The devil is so strong. Pray for those assemblies for their preservation. Not only that, but we would ask you to pray for the other towns around them, for as yet there are no assemblies. In some of those towns around Descalvado, gospel work is being carried on. Some of those brethren are going regularly every week into some of those other towns, and regular meetings are carried on. In some of those towns, one or two have got saved. We would value your prayers for the progress of the gospel all around that area. And finally, we would appreciate your prayers for us. When we return to Brazil again in the will of the Lord, we don't intend to settle down again in Descalvado. We feel that what had to be done around that area has been done. The brethren there are very active and capable. God has raised up men with ability to carry on the testimony. And it would be our exercise in returning to move a little farther forward, that we might reach into new ground again. When we think of a step like that, there are so many places as yet unreached. All need the gospel. But the important thing is to be in God's place, in God's time. And we would value your prayers for us, that they might be guided aright in every movement, moving in the center of God's will, that they might be of some use to Him in the furthering of His work.